my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Hit the rowdy road. Many kinds I've met there. Many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on I go. The seconds tick, the time out. There's so much left to know when I'm on.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I am your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers, advocates, and activists from around the world. We are now streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org, and you can click on the listen button there to hear us. KKRN is a community radio station supported by our listeners and underwriters, and we invite your support. You can go back to that same website, kkrn.org, and click on the donate button to support our efforts. Unspun is normally a call-in show, but because today's show is pre-recorded, we will not be taking calls in the studio. You can send me an email, though, if you'd like to correspond or let me know, comment or questions about the shows or other shows. You can email me at unspun@kkrn, just like it sounds, unspun@kkrn.org. Today, our guest is Stephen Zunes, professor of politics and international studies and chair of the Middle Eastern Studies Program at the University of San Francisco, where he teaches courses on the politics of Middle East and other regions, U.S. foreign policy, nonviolence, conflict resolution, and globalization. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy in Focus Project of the Institute for Policy Studies. He is an associate editor of Peace Review, a contributing editor to Tikkun, and a member of the Academic Advisory Council of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. He has written numerous articles, both scholarly and for the general public, on foreign policy and peace issues. He recently wrote an article entitled "The Five Lamest Excuses for Hillary Clinton's Vote to Invade Iraq." And earlier this week in Huffington Post, he had another article published. It's called "Bipartisan Congressional Efforts to Support Israeli Settlements and Expansionism." He is a longtime peace activist and a U.S. foreign policy critic. Let's welcome Stephen Zunes. Professor Zunes, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Great to be with you.
Where are you at now? You travel quite a bit, don't you?
Oh, this semester I'm a visiting professor at the National Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Otago in New Zealand.
So you hop around in your career also quite a bit, kind of interesting. And you're busy. You're involved in so many efforts and so many things, and you write pretty often, frequently. You're on Huffington Post and many other outlets and different journals, and I see your name a lot. Let's go back. I was thinking about when I first became aware of what you were doing, and that was back in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, and you were among some of the loudest voices challenging the lies of the Bush administration and warning about what a horrendous error it would be to invade a country that posed no threat to Americans. And I'm just wondering, have we learned any lessons from Iraq?
I'd like to think that we have. If politicians have, certainly the American people have, that the polls have shown there is unprecedented skepticism, especially among younger people, of these kinds of ill-advised interventions overseas. They recognize, you know, not only does it create further complications, in the case of Iraq, obviously, we have the rise of this Iraqi-led terrorist group known as ISIS, the so-called Islamic State. which is a direct consequence of the U.S. invasion, certainly has not made the region or the United States the more secure, but also the enormous cost of these wars, not just in terms of human lives, but fiscally, that the Iraq war so far has cost well over $1 trillion. And if you count the interest in the national debt, because remember, we borrowed money to pay for this war, have to pay it back with interest. The veterans' benefits, including for the many thousands of wounded warriors, those who permanent psychological disabilities as a result of their service, this could cost us $3 billion or more, not to mention, of course, the cost of the ongoing wars that this has created, like we've seen with the rise of ISIS. So this is money that could have been used for health care, for education, for housing, for public transit, for environmental issues, especially tackling the threat of climate change. And so you have pro-war politicians like Hillary Clinton saying, oh, we don't have enough money for single-payer health care. We don't have enough money to have free public higher education. And yet she and other politicians were willing to spend the hundreds of billions and counting for this illegal and unnecessary war.
Yeah, I think a lot of Americans really haven't understood what is going on in the Middle East. Of course, Iraq was one of several stepping stones that we have apparently had on our list for a while to either invoke regime change or somehow violently overthrow or undermine existing governments. And maybe I was trying to figure out, and maybe you could explain to people, because we have so much propaganda and misinformation on just about every news outlet that I've watched. I don't think any of them get it right, at least not the main networks. And we see that also in our foreign policy debates and the presidential debates. But is there an underlying rationale, do you think, that explains our government's policies and aggression in the Middle East and actually around the world? We could bring it into South America and Central America, too. It seems like we think violent intervention is somehow a good thing, and I just don't get the rationale.
Yes, it is rather bizarre that we see ourselves as a country based on the rule of law, and yet interventions such as the invasion of Iraq are a direct violation of the United Nations Charter, which as a signed and ratified treaty is, according to Article 6 of the Constitution, to be treated as supreme law. It forbids these kinds of aggressive wars. It justifies wars only in the event a country is attacked, and by extension, those who are treaty partners of such countries, or if the United Nations Security Council authorizes the use of force. Neither of these were the case in Iraq. The United States has certainly stretched definition of these treaty obligations at times, and we have certainly done illegal clandestine operations, such as sponsoring coup d'etats, which overthrew governments we didn't like. But the Iraq wars was almost this blatant act of aggression this country has engaged in many decades. And you have a very bad precedent. I mean, if the United States, with all its resources, diplomatically, economically, and otherwise, can't play by the rules, why should anybody else? In many ways, gives a license to the ISISs and the Al-Qaedas of the world, to violate international legal norms as well. I think that a lot of this goes back to the contradictions we had in our own founding. On the one hand, our country was based on very progressive, idealistic values. On the other hand, there was this, what we were doing to the indigenous population in this country in the name of civilizing them, the whole idea of manifest destiny going back to the Puritans, the idea that America was a city on the hill, the New Jerusalem, and somehow we were better than other people, and therefore we had the right to expand westward and conquer indigenous nations and extend that to the Pacific with Hawaii, Guam, Philippines, and in many ways continue this kind of process globally. And when it's reinforced by powerful economic interests that benefit from such expansionism and opportunistic politicians who believe that stirring up this kind of jingoism can help them politically, it becomes a pretty dangerous combination, and ironically ends up being very counter to the values that most Americans hold dear of supporting human rights and supporting the rule of law, supporting democracy.
Yeah, I guess we should wonder as Americans what our foreign policy is going to look like. They're touting now that Hillary has basically clinched the nomination. I'm not sure that's true, but I can't imagine the choice between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. I'm tempted to just throw my vote away. I mean, it almost sickens me, quite honestly, because neither of these people seem to value diplomacy. Here's Hillary Clinton, supposed to, Secretary of State, ex-Secretary of State under Obama. I think, as you pointed out, she doesn't seem to have a firm grasp on the reality if Iraq is any consideration. So what is a Hillary Clinton or a Donald Trump presidency going to look like? It's kind of scary to me.
It is rather disturbing on a number of levels. Obviously, Donald Trump his jingoism and extreme rhetoric this idea that we can kill families of terrorists and torture and violate these kinds of international legal standards, obviously, are rather frightening. But also Hillary Clinton, despite sort of trying to portray herself as a progressive candidate, is definitely one of the more hawkish Democrats, or certainly her record in the Senate, put her at that wing of the party. And what's amazing about her supporters rationalizing her for her defense of the invasion of Iraq, saying, she thought they had weapons of mass destruction. Well, there's no reason she should have thought that. She was briefed by a number of people, she and her staff, myself included, that the Bush administration's claims had no bearing in reality. All the data that was released to members of Congress has now been declassified. I've read it, transparently weak, especially in light of reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency that Iraq had disarmed all its nuclear materials, the fact that 95% of the chemical weapons had been accounted for and destroyed, and the 5% that wasn't accounted for, which had also incidentally been destroyed, was so old that it was no longer weapons grade. They didn't have any missiles, delivery systems, and in any case. You could go down the list, and it was pretty clear that Iraq constituted no threat. Her claims that they had ties to Al-Qaeda was ludicrous. She was the only Democratic senator that made that claim. Al-Qaeda and the Saddam regime were bitter enemies, and that was well known. Also, if they really did have weapons of mass destruction, there are over two dozen countries that have such weapons. Does that mean the United States has the right to invade all of them? We have a right to invade North Korea, China, Pakistan, India, Israel, Iran, Britain, France, Egypt. Do countries have the right to invade us? We still have chemical weapons, so we certainly have. We don't just have a nuclear program. We have actual nuclear weapons, thousands of them. This logic was rather disturbing. Not to mention the fact, of course, that she was also briefed by Middle East scholars and people like myself who recognized that the United States invaded Iraq, regardless of whether they actually had these weapons or not, we'd be dragged down in a long, bloody counterinsurgency war amidst the rise of Islamist extremism, sectarian violence, that could destabilize much of the region, increase anti-American extremism. And this is exactly what has happened. I wrote about this in detail in the cover story of The Nation magazine, the oldest political magazine in the country. I mean, this is all common knowledge, at least among those of us who were familiar with Iraq and familiar with the strategic situation. And the fact that she would ignore the broad consensus of Middle East scholars and independent arms control analysts, and instead trust Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and some neoconservative ideologues, is some indication of I fear the kind of advice she will take in formulating her her foreign policy. I think if you look at some of her other policies around Israel-Palestine, she has allied herself with the more right-wing elements, the Netanyahu government. Bernie Sanders and to a lesser extent Barack Obama has supported some of the more moderate elements in Israel. Hillary Clinton's even done photo ops at Israeli settlements and defended other Israeli violations of international law, including the bombing of those United Nations schools in Gaza, killing those refugees, and Israel building this separation barrier deep inside occupied Palestinian territory. She played a role in consolidating the coup in Honduras and blocking the return of the democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya. She has supported not just Israel's occupation, but Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara, the former Spanish colony that Morocco seized in 1975. She says it should be incorporated into Morocco as part of some dubious autonomy agreement, not allowing the people the right of self-determination as required. I could go down the list, but she's definitely will move our foreign policy back more towards the Bush era, I believe, away from the more restrained policy of the Obama administration. And it's ironic that here we have Barack Obama, who has bombed no less than seven Muslim countries since coming to office, yet Hillary Clinton has said he's not been assertive enough in the use of U.S. military
force. Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Professor Stephen Zunis, Middle Eastern policy critic and peace advocate. We're discussing the failed U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and what that means for peace in the region. Today's show is pre-recorded, so we will not be taking calls in the studio. Well, let's come back to Israel. I have watched this for years and years. I'm sure you have, too. We watch every president makes, I think, at least one attempt to create peace between in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Every time I watch it, I go, why are we doing this again? Because it doesn't seem to me that the U.S. or Israel wants peace. It's not serving them. And I just thought maybe to get your perspective on that, because I just don't get it.
Well, by my own view, and I think the view of most Americans, is that both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs have the right of self-determination. To live in a secure nation state. But the fact is, even if we assume that both peoples have equal rights, there's not equality in terms of the power relationship. Israel is the occupying power. And in international law and historically, it is the occupying power that the onus is on the democratic, onus is on the occupying power to make the necessary compromises for peace. And the U.S. attitude for years has been, oh, let the two sides work it out themselves. And, that's like, saying, Russian Ukraine should work it out among themselves, or Iraq and Kuwait, when Iraq invaded that country, should work it out among themselves, or Indonesian East Timor should work it out among themselves. It's unreasonable, given the lack of leverage that a country under occupation has in these situations expect that the occupying power that has all the tools at their disposal would necessarily agree to compromise. And so I've always advocated a policy of tough love, that is unconditional support for Israel's right to exist in peace, security, but a willingness to use pressure, including conditioning some of the more than $3 billion of currently unconditional military aid that we provide that right-wing government to get them to withdraw from the occupied territories in return for security guarantees, which the Palestine Authority has already provided them, already offered them. And the United Nations is in talk of maybe the UN Security Council could impose a solution similar along the lines of the Taban negotiations in January 2001 or the Geneva Initiative in December of 2003. These were supported by the Palestine Authority, by Fatah, by the PLO, and by leading moderate elements within Israel, where Israel would be able to hold on to most of the illegal settlements, at least in terms of the population, in return for an equivalent amount of land to Israel. Because right now, Palestinians are only asking for 22% of historic Palestine, and the U.S. and Israeli position is that's too much. You need to compromise more. But Jerusalem be a co-capital of both countries and access to holy places, demilitarized Palestinian state, no wholesale right of return for Palestinians to Israel itself, but a way to resettle the refugees, either in Arab countries or the new Palestinian state. This has all been spelled out, and Palestinians, not Hamas, of course, that controls the Gaza Strip, but the Palestinian Authority, the recognized government that controls most of the urban areas of the West Bank, they've agreed to this. But Israel refuses, and so I think it's important that the United States take a more proactive role and be willing to put the necessary pressure on Israel to make the necessary compromises for peace. And unfortunately, we have not. Hillary Clinton has rejected it. The Republicans have rejected it, and in fact, the Republicans have been accusing Obama of not supporting Israel enough, even though he's sending more aid than any president in U.S. history. Despite the fact that objectively Israel is stronger militarily relative to all Arab neighbors than it ever has been in its history.
Well, and we can look at Bernie Sanders, too. I don't think any American president or, congressman, senator, I don't think any of them want to stand up to AIPAC, which is basically a Zionist group that has a lot of influence and money and can bring a lot of political pressure on these people. Yeah. So I don't see Bernie Sanders even making a statement that he would somehow bring Israel into line with the UN.
Yeah, he hasn't been that explicit, though he has been far more critical of Israeli policies than the Obama administration, or even and much more so than Hillary Clinton. He aligns himself much more, and he considers himself a Zionist. He certainly supports Israel. He actually worked in a kibbutz as a young man for a better part of a year. So, he has, and he is Jewish, but he does believe that Israel will only really be secure if it is willing to end the occupation, stop expanding these illegal settlements. And he's also been willing to speak out. He says Israel certainly has a right of self-defense, especially when you have Hamas lobbing rockets in their territory, but they don't have a right to bomb urban neighborhoods and kill hundreds upon hundreds of civilians. And he condemned that as being disproportionate and unjustifiable. And while Hillary Clinton has supported this sort of thing, so he has made it stood out to some degree. Though some people do believe, myself included, he could be somewhat stronger. My own view, frankly, is that the U.S. support for the right wing in Israel, and I don't even like to call it U.S. support for Israel because I think a lot of what the United States is supporting is actually harmful to Israel in the long term. But the support given to the Netanyahu government is not simply a matter of the power of AIPAC and the pro-Israel lobby. Because when you think about it, the United States does support Morocco and its occupation of Western Sahara for decades. We support Indonesia and its occupation of East Timor. Back during the 60s and 70s, we supported South Africa's occupation in Namibia under the apartheid regime. So it's not like we need an ethnic minority group with a lot of political clout to force our country to back an allied government occupying and oppressing a weaker neighbor. And unfortunately, we have a history of doing that regardless. And I think AIPAC certainly made the political climate such that, and then similar right-wing Zionist groups have made the political climate so that it is more difficult to challenge these kinds of policies. But I think the overall thrust of U.S. policy towards Israel-Palestine, frankly, would be more or less the same, even if AIPAC didn't exist. And we're seeing growing movement, you know, challenging that. But again, fighting back, I mean, just a few days ago, in fact, the Board of Regents passed a statement that basically conflated anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, saying that if you are anti-Zionism is a form of discrimination that, quote, have no place at the University of California. Now, I personally see Zionism as, like other nationalist movements, as diverse. You have some progressive elements along with some pretty reactionary, militaristic ones, but it is a legitimate intellectual argument to raise questions about Zionism, and it's legitimate to defend Zionism. But to say that being anti-Zionist is the same as being racist or anti-Semitic, and it has no place at the university, that impresses me as an attack on academic freedom. And I think these are the kinds of things that I think are indeed the could be attributed to the influence of right wing Zionist groups that try to stifle debate on the question. But again, I think in terms of our overall Middle East policy, including towards Israel-Palestine, it unfortunately is quite consistent with our policies we've seen historically in Latin America, Southern Africa, Southeast Asia, and elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, I got in trouble. I wrote an op-ed a few years back, and it was questioning right-wing Zionists, and I think most Zionists are right-wing, whether they understand they are or not, by supporting Zionism. And, of course, Zionism existed before Israel, and it exists separately, and it has, I think, all along. And you could even question if it's Zionism is good for Israel. I don't think it is, because I think it's putting Israel in a place. I wouldn't want to live in Israel, quite honestly. There's so much going on there, and there's always a threat. And as we, assuming with the support of Israel, seem to be overthrowing more and more secular governments in the region, it makes me think creating chaos. By doing that, there seems to be a pattern where the U.S. is part of our policy overthrowing secular leaders. You could say Saddam was a secular leader. Probably Assad, Syria is considered a secular leader. We did the same thing in Iran.
Gaddafi.
Yeah. And when we do this, we open the door, and I think purposely so, and even finance and supply arms to all these different groups that we know are going to be at one another's throats. We've turned Saudi Arabia loose, apparently. They think they can just bomb all over the Middle East now, and we're supplying arms. And I think there was an article yesterday or the day before that Obama is thinking about selling or giving another $1 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia. I mean, this is chaos, and someday it's going to come back to bite Israel too, I'm sure.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, we hear people say that the rise of Islamist extremism is anti-Americanism in that part of the world is because they hate our freedoms. And while I think we have every right to be proud of our individual liberties and electoral democracy and all that kind of good stuff, the fact is our policy in the Middle East has had very little to do with freedom. It's been about supporting these brutal allied dictatorships, including the theocratic, misogynist regime in Saudi Arabia. I mean, talk about Islamic extremism. I mean, they're worse than Iran and a lot of countries that we oppose. You know, we support dictators that oppress their people. We support occupying armies like those of Israel and Morocco. Most people in the Middle East don't see our freedom and democracy at work. They see Made in USA on tear gas canisters and bomb casings that are attacking their people. We end up supporting dictatorships and occupying armies that suppress nonviolent pro-democracy movements and then turn around and say, they don't have much democracy in the Middle East because it's not part of Arab or Muslim culture. You know, if we... And there's people over there, they're just so violent, they want to kill each other. Well, where are most of their weapons coming from? The vast majority of weapons in the Middle East that are killing innocent people. In fact, the majority of the weapons that ISIS has are of U.S. manufacture. I've seen no evidence the U.S. has given arms to ISIS directly, but, you know, they have gotten it through, you know, various pro-American regimes, or captured it, or from pro-American regimes, or gotten through the black market, or whatever. But, you know, the point is that, directly or indirectly, we are arming extremist elements there that are killing ordinary people, and we are supporting governments that are creating conditions that lead to extremism. As John F. Kennedy warned many years ago, those who make peaceful evolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. And so I think this the failure of the United States to support democratic change in that part of the world, the failure of the United States to recognize that, you know, that intervention creates blowback that ends up unleashing even more dangerous forces is a major, and of course the massive amount of arms we send to the region is the underlying cause of the instability in that part of the world that is not inherent in Arab and Islamic culture. And indeed, the greater Middle East, for most of between the around the 1400s up until about a little over 100 years ago, was actually more peaceful and more stable than Europe. And it's only been when European colonialists, and then followed by neocolonialists like the United States, and arguably to a lesser extent the Russians, have come in and helped destabilize the area and arm the area and the like. This is I would argue is the real problem in the region. Nothing inherent within the culture or religious faith of the people.
Let me interrupt you there to remind our listeners you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Professor Stephen Zunes, Middle Eastern policy critic and peace advocate, and we're discussing the failed U.S. policy in the Middle East and what that means for peace in the region. Today's show is pre-recorded, so we won't be taking calls in the studio as we normally do. I just read and thinking on we tend to think militarily, but underlying this military domination, which seems to be our path since the Second World War, there's also the economic and other. You know, we bring sanctions down on Iran and Iraq, and we do a lot of damage that way. And recently, Ellen Brown, I don't know if you're familiar with her work, she'd written a couple books on public banking, but this article she wrote, she links the U.S. regime change tactics to the control of oil and the perpetuation of the petrodollar. And thinking back after reading this, I really, you know, Saddam Hussein had started selling oil in euros just before we invaded Iraq. Libya was working with other African nations to create a shared currency based on the Libyan dinar. And they were both illegally attacked by the U.S., their infrastructure destroyed, leaders murdered. So what part, we know that in Ukraine we saw the same thing too, and when Russia was going to lend Ukraine's legitimate government money to get out of debt, and we saw it attacked, and then immediately the IMF and the EU stepped in to put the Ukraine under the new fascists, I call them fascists, fascist government in Ukraine, sort of put them in debt and put, you know, so now they fall under the Western capitalist scheme of things. Mm-hmm. So what part do you think of our policies and our aggression in the world are dictated by bankers and international energy interests?
Well, I don't think it's quite as direct as you implied in those examples. I think those examples were more complex in a number of levels. But I do think that there's no question that in the overall scheme of things, the advance of Western financial interests has long been a very important part of U.S. policy. It is one thing in the mix, along with, you know, various nationalistic and militaristic and other tendencies and in some cases misplaced liberal internationalism, misguided liberal internationalism, which I think was a key factor in the Libya debacle. But I think that it's rarely as direct as bankers coming into the White House and saying, we want you to do X, Y, Z. I mean, there were some incidents of that in the early part of the 20th century when we invaded a number of Caribbean and Central American countries that owed debts to American banks. But it tends to be a little more indirect. I mean, obviously, for example, I did my doctoral dissertation, and it's eventually going to become a book, about that looked at the U.S. Overthrow of the democratically elected government in Guatemala and Iran back in the 1950s. And, you know, I had assumed that, we'd overthrown Guatemala for the sake of the United Fruit and that government in Iran, you know, for the sake of the oil companies. But it ends up that it was a little more indirect than that, in that from all the memos that have since been declassified, all the internal communication, things like that, I saw no direct evidence of that. What I did see, however, was that these companies helped spin the narrative that Iran and Guatemala were about to be taken over by communists. And this is during the Cold War, and they helped, you know, fuel that kind of fear and paranoia, which then, led to the coups. In other words, because of the powerful influence that these companies have in terms of public opinion, in terms of journalists and media, in terms of lobbyists, in terms of who gets the ear of the president and his advisors and key members in Congress, they can certainly have a role in twisting the narrative in such a way that encourages these interventions that help their perceived interests. Because you remember that a lot of these people really don't, that are in power, even the fairly intelligent ones, don't know that thoroughly, the history of these countries, the internal dynamics of these countries, and therefore the ramifications of what intervention might mean. Many of our recent presidents were governors, or if they were in Congress, they focused on domestic issues. I couldn't make very good policy about, say, fisheries or farming issues or things like that. I would have to rely on advisors and what I read and what people tell me. Similarly, there are people who you don't have presidents who are foreign policy experts like myself, or regional experts like myself, or whatever, and they have to rely on what they hear, what people tell them. And so I think there's no question that very powerful corporations and banking interests do play a major role in what people in positions of power hear and how they understand the world. So I think in that way they have influence. I don't think in other words, I don't think it's quite as conspiratorial as some people might put it. But again, it would be naive to think that is simply random, that these policies do so often reflect the interest of the rich and powerful.
And I think we confuse and purposely confuse politically national interests with interests of corporations and banks. And Alan Greenspan famously said in his book, I forget the title now after he retired, but he said, I thought everybody knew that the invasion of Iraq was about oil. And, you know, of course, that's an oversimplification, as you say, but there seems to be this monetary, whether it be resources or Gaddafi had, I forget how many, 150 tons of gold or something, and was working on creating a different currency system. So mm-hmm. that's a threat to the petrodollar, and he was also a large oil producer. And you take the same thing with Iran. They were overthrown, I think, in 1953, Mossadegh, basically for oil. He wanted to nationalize Iran's oil and let it belong to the people. And so they got rid of him, and we could go on and on. Different dictators that we put in place, Pinochet, who's the Arbenz, I don't know. There's Pol Pot. I mean, the list goes on and on. I think you said that before. But if we look at the petrodollar, and looking forward now, we're lately, and we haven't talked about the press too much, what Ray McGovern calls the fawning corporate media, but I think we are suffering under certain delusions about who we are because of the press. We don't look at our real history, and now we're setting out to demonize Russia again. I guess we don't have enough military sales. I don't know what we can't let Lockheed Martin show a loss on their sheet or a loss of their stock price. So what, I think there's an obvious monetary and natural resource side to all of these things. There, like you say, it's not a simple thing, but looks like a pretty good pattern there. And what do you think about what's going on, the demonization of Russia?
Well, I think part of the criticism of Russia, of course, is deserved. Putin has become increasingly authoritarian. His seizure of Crimea was definitely illegal, as well as supporting some of those nationalist rebels in eastern Ukraine. But I think one thing that the press really misses out is that the United States has, in many ways, and in certain ways, Western European countries as well, has provoked this kind of nationalist reaction in Russia through the eastward expansion of NATO, which was totally unnecessary. I mean, a lot of us just assumed that with the demise of the Warsaw Pact and Soviet Union, that NATO would cease to exist. After all, NATO was created to challenge what feared Soviet aggression in Western Europe. So why still have NATO? Well, instead of disbanding NATO, we've actually expanded it to former countries in the Warsaw Pact and even former Soviet republics, like the Baltic states. And this is seen as incredibly provocative. Russia has been invaded from Europe repeatedly in history, World War II, World War I, Napoleon. I mean, they lost 20 million lives. Soviet Union lost 20 million people in the Nazi invasion, and this stokes this very kind of paranoid reaction, and that Putin has been stoking, and the expansion of NATO had no real strategic rationale, but it made an enormous amount of money for American arms manufacturers as these countries had to replace their old Soviet-era equipment to become compatible with NATO's U.S.-built equipment. And and we're seeing the reaction as a result. And of course, there's been this tug of war between Russia and the West for influence in Ukraine. The Ukrainians, you know, given their history of subjugation for centuries, are strongly nationalistic. They don't want to be controlled by either side. I have a slightly different interpretation of the uprising against Yanukovych. I do believe that it was a genuine, you know, popular, overwhelmingly nonviolent uprising, but you certainly had neo-fascist elements as well as the United States and Western powers trying to take advantage of it in ways to support you know, their interests, and ways that just kind of reconfirmed again the Russia's paranoia of even further Western expansion. Ukraine, of course, is very, very important to Russia. It was part of Russia for 350 years. Culturally and linguistically, they're very, very close, very, very entwined. I mean, it is more important than any of the other former Soviet republics. And this lack of sensitivity to Russian concerns is very short-sighted. Again, this doesn't justify a number of the actions that Putin has taken, but to act like he just kind of did this out of the blue, without rhyme or reason, I think really is distorting the recent history.
Let's talk about Syria. Russia apparently, at the invitation of the Syrian government, went and got involved with airstrikes, much like we do all over the world. They took a lot of grief for that, but now they're leaving. And I guess my question would be, is this wise on their part? Are they smarter than we are to get out of this mess while they can, or are they just turning it over to forces that would get rid of Assad, which would include the United States?
I think the ceasefire, I think it was more of a tactical decision, frankly. I think that the ceasefire, which is includes most of the more moderate rebel elements, has freed Syrian firepower to focus on ISIS, al-Nusra, and the more extremist elements. So there's, you know, less of a perceived need for Russian military intervention. I think the United States, you know, had and some other and some allies, both in Europe and the Middle East, had hoped initially, of course, that more moderate elements would be able to overthrow Assad, or that some of the more Islamist groups would be enough of a threat so that Assad would compromise with the more moderate ones. The fact that the Islamists ended up dominating much of the armed resistance, they ended up, you know, alienating a lot of people who opposed Assad but thought that the Islamists would be even worse, and, you know, combined with Russian air power, and, you know, made it pretty clear belatedly that a military solution to the conflict was not doable. And so the U.S. was willing to work with the Russians and others in making this ceasefire arrangement. Now, the initial uprising against Assad in 2011 was largely spontaneous. It was nonviolent. It was diverse. People from all sorts of ethnic and religious, backgrounds, and included some very, very good progressive elements. Unfortunately, it was brutally, brutally suppressed by the Assad regime. And then you started having along with some defectors from the Syrian army, bringing home their weapons, and with the U.S. allies in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, others starting to arm Islamist groups, and then the United States starting to arm various groups, you know, ended up in this horrific civil war that has killed nearly a quarter million people and displaced millions more. I think it's such a tragedy, you know, because I think it could have been avoided. I mean, there are missteps on all sides around this. But I think it's not a good answer of what to do. And you can go back in history when the United States helped overthrow the last democratic government that Syria had back in the late 1949. You can look at the French role in giving the Alawites disproportionate influence in the military. You can look at all sorts of things that help set this up. But I think the more immediate, cause, has indeed been the repression of the Syrian regime and the extremist Islamist elements that are challenging it. And ordinary Syrians are the ones who are caught in the middle. And why I don't think the United States, unlike some problems in the world, is not the primary culpable party in this tragedy. I think the efforts to bring in arms has just frankly poured more fuel on the fire. It has just increased suffering. And of course the equation of ISIS, as I mentioned earlier in the hour, very much was a direct outcome of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. So we certainly have a lot of responsibility on that regard. But I really think we need to have a more cautious approach that can help hopefully end the conflict for good and try to rebuild the Syrian civil society, who are the ones who launched the rebellion initially, and I believe are the people who really should determine the future of Syria, not the Assad regime, not the armed militias. Certainly not the United States and other foreign powers, but the people of Syria themselves.
Yeah, but Assad wasn't even invited to the table when they were discussing the ceasefire. So here we leave the government elected by the people out of the equation altogether, as though it's just a pawn. Syria is just a pawn for the larger nations. The other part of Syria, I think, is interesting, and we look at the timing. We famously went into Libya a week after the Fukushima accident, and Fukushima went completely – it went away in the media. We still haven't heard about Fukushima. Interesting timing there. Saw what happened in Libya where we destroyed that nation. Now, and immediately after that, it seems like some of those same forces and the U.S. support went over to the rebels in Syria. So to me, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, oh, the State Department, which is apparently run by neocons more or less, they were fine with all of this, and they saw that Syria or Libya to them was somehow some kind of really quick answer. So maybe they thought they'd move that model over and use it in Syria. Our government was more than ready to step in there, where maybe if we hadn't, things could have been more peacefully settled.
It's hard to say. I mean, I think there are a lot of other outside actors besides the United States, the Turks, the Saudis, the Qataris, and others. Yeah, I mean, there is a fair amount of evidence that with the collapse of the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime, that there were elements of the State Department and CIA that were funneling the vast quantities of arms that were suddenly available to some of those two rebels in Syria. That though Obama, to his credit, resisted calls that the United States start bombing, as we did in Libya, from an early stage, Obama would recognize that there are dangers in empowering some of the more extreme Islamist sectors too much. Though there are certainly elements within the administration intelligence community that have less of a problem with that. Ironically, the United States actually and other European countries were getting along with Gaddafi once they had the settlement over the Lockerbie situation, when he opened up his oil companies to cooperate more with international oil. Things that looked like we were going to treat him as we would other Arab dictators, ignoring the repression at home. When the uprising began, we started to see interest in supporting the rebels, and it was supposed to be just a no-fly zone to protect civilians from attack, but we quickly escalated that to become essentially the air force for the rebel armies, going well beyond our mandate from the United Nations and the Arab League, and actually playing a key role in overthrowing the regime. And I'm sure these guys had dollar signs in their eyes of what post Gaddafi Libya could be, but all these folks have pulled out now because Libya, of course, is in total chaos as these armed groups, many of whom are Islamist extremists, are fighting each other and vying for power. And in many ways, it's a failed state. It's a huge tragedy. And as with Syria and Iraq and other misadventures, we're seeing how it is further destabilizing the region. It led to the overthrow of the democratically elected government in Mali and the rise of Islamists among the Tuaregs in that part of the country. I mean, all sorts of things have spilled over. And so, again, it's just a guide that, you know, whether you see the intervention as misguided liberal internationalism, you know, a humanitarian intervention gone awry, or whether you see it in a more conspiratorial way in terms of U.S. finance and oil, either way, it has been a disaster and should be yet another cautionary tale.
Well, Stephen, we've got about 3 minutes left. I guess in a general way, because I know you also work very hard for peaceful solutions. Is there a chance of having peaceful solutions in the Middle East in my lifetime or in the next 50 years? Is there actually a possibility after we've stirred up this hornet's nest?
Well, I mean, I think if you look back to Latin America 30 years ago, you saw these horrific civil wars in Central America, fueled by U.S. intervention and the backing of right-wing terrorist groups like the Contras and these brutal repressive regimes that are killing tens of thousands of civilians in Guatemala and El Salvador. You saw these brutal military regimes in places like Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, et cetera. And yet, today in Latin America, it is relatively peaceful. The economies are growing. Many of these countries have elected left-leaning governments, which are enabling these countries to go in a more independent direction. And so, you know, it's very possible the Middle East could, in the next 20 or 30 years, become more peaceful and prosperous as well. I think, though, the outside of Tunisia, there was not much progress immediately from the so-called Arab Spring, but the fact that you have millions and millions of people in Egypt, Bahrain, Yemen, Syria, elsewhere, marching for freedom and justice and engaging in massive nonviolent resistance, shows that there is potential for civil society to create change. That Arabs and Muslims don't like being jailed, murdered, and tortured for their political beliefs any more than Western Christians do. Arabs and Muslims do not like authoritarian regimes and corruption and social inequities. That everyone wants to have a better life for themselves and for their children, and so they reject both the traditional authoritarian governments, whether they be pro-West or anti-West, and they reject the Islamist extremists as well. And so I think that this new generation of Arabs and other Middle Easterners, I think, their polls show that their attitudes are quite progressive and nationalistic, and they want to they reject both reactionary Islam and Western imperialism and dictatorship. And I think these are the future. These are the people we should look for. I think those are the people who are going to build a better Middle East if we leave them alone and not try to stifle their efforts.
Well, we are out of time, and I just want to thank you, Professor Stephen Zunes. Thanks for being on Unspun with us today.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. Our guest today has been Stephen Zunes, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, Middle East scholar and international advocate for peace. Links and archives of this show will be up on KKRN.org and PRX.org for rebroadcasts. Next week on Unspun, we will have journalist Jeremy R. Hammond. He is an award-winning independent political analyst, author, and founding editor and publisher of Foreign Policy Journal. Tune in next week, or you can stream it live on KKRN 88.5 or KKRN.org.